Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 301 for September 4th of 2015, A Fake City for Tomorrow's Cars. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary Vasilash. Here we are, 301.
301, yeah. There's 301. No cheers and explosions, but how you doing?
I'm doing well. Got a lot of cool stuff to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
We may be joined by one of our other colleagues, Daron Levine.
That's right.
Talking about his new venture with Sirius XM Radio mm-hmm. and what he's going to be doing there. But he's not here yet. I think he's caught in traffic, but he'll show up later.
Mm-hmm.
But what we should let everybody know is our special guest for this part of the show is Peter Sweatman. Now, I don't know the official part of your title. You with Umtree? You with M-City?
It's funny you should ask, because as of last Monday, I'm no longer the director of Umtree. So after 11 years,
we should tell everybody, Umtree is the University of Michigan
Transportation Research Institute. Yeah. Exactly. So that was an honor to do that for so long. But in the last 2 years, I've had two hats, and of course the new one, MTC, the Mobility Transformation Center, has really taken off. So it was time to really divest myself a little bit and go full-time into MTC.
So. But you're still doing advanced research, really, in automotive,
Absolutely.
What you're running there.
Yeah.
So explain what all this advanced mobility transportation stuff is that you're working on.
Well, I guess, John, the best way to explain it is that, you know, we were fortunate enough to win a big federal project about 3 or 4 years ago on connected vehicles. And so we got to actually do the biggest deployment that's been done anywhere of connected cars, buses, trucks, motorcycles. Connected together and connected with the infrastructure, communicating. And so we had the opportunity to run that, to bring volunteers in the city of Ann Arbor to try these technologies out. And these are the connected technologies. So these are technologies that give the driver warnings about imminent crashes and so on. And we found that we collected a tremendous amount of data, which was then used to create a rulemaking process federally. So the good news is that all vehicles from a certain date will have this platform. But in the process, you know, we learned a lot on the ground in Ann Arbor as to how people, real users, appreciate these sort of technologies. So, for example, the folks of Ann Arbor love the kind of situation where we call it electronic brake light, where a vehicle's braking harshly, several vehicles ahead of yours. You can't even see the vehicle, let alone the fact that it's braking suddenly. And yet that information comes into your vehicle straight away. And so that was something that the users, our volunteers, love that.
So is this technology that was developed at the university, or is this technology that suppliers and OEMs brought to you and said, okay, you guys test it?
It's a big partnership. So those technologies were developed by OEMs, by suppliers, and so on. All of that. And the idea was to have as many different vendors as we could, because we needed to make sure everything would work together. So so that was part of our job. So and a lot of the standards have been pushed by the U.S. Department of Transportation. So you need those standards. But we proved that you could have many vendors involved and this whole thing would work. So that was pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. So now you've you've sort of evolved from being in connected car, going much more to what? All this mobility services kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, so a few things happen. So once you take connectivity, and we call it V2X, vehicle-to-vehicle, V2V, vehicle-to-infrastructure, V2I, but it could be vehicle-to-anything. It could be vehicle-to-pedestrian and so on. So we call it V2X. So that's very powerful. But if you combine that with various levels of automation, then you truly have a transformation. And then, as you suggest, we start to think differently about mobility. We start to think about, well, would I need to own one of those? Or maybe I'd like to own lots of them because I can do lots of things at the same time. So lots of interesting questions come up. But I think the fact that we were successful with the connected technology really encourages to go further. And, of course, the idea with the connected technology always was that we'd bring an element of automation into it.
So explain what automation is for our listeners and viewers.
So by automation, we mean that the machine itself, the vehicle, is steering or braking according to some situation that it recognizes. So it's not you applying the brakes, but the brakes are being applied by the machine, by a computer in the vehicle.
So for example, your car detects that someone's going to run a red light, it's going to hit the brakes for you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of pieces of automation now already available in vehicles. So these kind of systems where the vehicle detects that you're moving out of the lane and it sort of suggests that you might want to, there's a little bit of steering automatically, the machine steers. So that's all automation. Or the idea that, you know, the car parks itself. That's automation.
So what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is it the intelligent car or the intelligent environment that the car is in?
Well, I think the intelligent car comes first. So the intelligent car is pretty well advanced. So, and there's a word for that. The word autonomous means that the vehicle's got everything in it needs to recognize the environment, to react correctly, and to drive. So that autonomous goal is certainly achievable, and some companies like Google are pushing very aggressively for autonomy. Others would say, you know, would talk about levels of automation. So some companies would say, we want to take the really boring bits out of driving, you know. So if you're a truck driver, long-distance truck driver, and you're stuck in traffic somewhere on the edge of a city somewhere or something, then the machine will take care of that, and then the driver will take over once you get through that. So there are a lot of different approaches to it, and that's one of the interesting things I think about this field at the moment. There's a lot of talk about driverless vehicles and all kinds of connected vehicles and so on. But really, it's pretty complex when you think about all the different types of products that might be available, what kind of situations they would actually work under, but certainly not in some other situations. So, you know, we get asked a lot about, you know, when is this all going to happen and so on. Well, you know, the answer really is predicated on exactly what you're talking about, because there are many, many levels, many, many, many types of technology and many, many different situations that they might be applied to.
Did anything surprise you? So you guys were doing the connected vehicle for 3 years. Did anything surprise you? Did anything come out of that you had to step back and say, we maybe need to rethink this?
No, I don't think. I think the system had been pretty well worked through by the time we got to it. I think, I guess one of the interesting aspects from my point of view is that it's a platform and then it has various applications placed on the platform. And, you know, the applications are pretty much infinite, that you know, unlimited, that you could dream up. And so we were testing six or seven particular applications. And I suppose the more experience you have, then you start to think of many, many other ways these applications could be set. We invented a few ourselves, such as with a bus. So if a bus is stopping at a bus stop, one of the problems with, and it comes up a lot in cities like New York City where there's a high pedestrian injury and fatality rate, because drivers of large vehicles like buses can't see the pedestrians in front of them. So they get off the bus and they walk in front of the bus and they can't see them. So we had an application that provided that information to the driver, and that was from the roadside. So that wireless communication was coming, being detected in the roadside. There were pedestrians there, and that information was coming into the driver. So, you know, because that's an interesting application for the city of Ann Arbor, especially with, you know, university town, lots of students and so on. But then you realize that wherever you deploy these things, ideas like that are going to come up. And that's the beauty of this thing, that the applications are really software. So once you have the platform, then there's a tremendous amount that you can do.
And you've gone out and built what I call the Potemkin Village, the sort of fake city that's being called M-City. Talk about that, but we also got a question here from one of the viewers, Steve B., who wants to know, can the average person show up and check out what's going on at M-City? Okay. So first, what is it, and then can anybody go look?
Okay. So, you know, I often call it a fake downtown. You call it a Potemkin Village. Some friends of mine call it a Western town, you know. So it's a realistic representation of a dense, complex, urban situation, which we think is the challenging situation for automated vehicles.
Here, we've even got it up
so
on the screen.
It's 32 acres of property that you have turned into this M-City.
32 acres and it's on the campus in Ann Arbor of University of Michigan. So the students and faculty can get, you know, it's interesting because when we take people out there, and we do that a lot, as you could imagine, we put people in the car, they settle back, they think they're in for a 10, 15, 20-minute ride, and, you know, we're there in about half a minute, you know. So it's a great thing to have it so nearby. But what we've done is to combine all sorts of ideas across the university, and that's what's so interesting about it. So faculty are interested in human factors, you know, how do humans react, how do they perceive, how do they act, but also robotics, and to bring those kind of ideas together. And so it's actually all the cross-sections are totally representative. So the widths of the roadways, the curbs, the median strips, all of that sort of stuff are all totally realistic. And then we truncate the length so that we move very quickly from one kind of situation to another. So we've got the we've got the downtown area, we've got a suburban area, we've got a rural area, and we've got a kind of a freeway situation with ramps as well. And it's all crammed into these 32 acres. So, and of course, with robotics research, you want to do continuous loops, and you want to be able to vary them. And so we designed it so that can be done. There's a tremendous amount of different features in there, whether it's to do with lane configurations, surfacings, you know, concrete, asphalt, gravel, traffic signals, lighting systems, building facades. We can adjust the building facades to be closer to the roadway, stagger them, whatever it is. So there's a tremendous amount going on there. The one thing that a lot of folks have been out and they ask the question eventually about, well, where are the potholes? And we don't have any potholes in there. So I'm
not,
kind of...
Not yet.
Not yet.
This is in Michigan. Come on, let's be realistic.
So that's the one thing we don't yet have.
Mm-hmm. So we got another question here from a viewer as well. Armin wants to know, do you believe there's still a hurdle that needs to be cleared before we see fully autonomous vehicles on the road?
Yeah, I think there's a number of hurdles. So I guess the way I look at it is we're going to go through quite a protracted period where, and maybe forever, where we have a mix of machines that are very intelligent interacting with conventionally driven vehicles. So I think the real hurdles are to do with that. They're to do with questions like, you know, that the occupant might have to take over and do something occasionally. Are they really going to be able to purposefully have their attention recalled from whatever they might be doing while they're in the vehicle when they don't have to drive and pay attention? So questions like that, but also the interaction between the machines and the human-driven vehicles. And I guess the way I put it is that the human drivers cheat. You know, they speed, they tailgate, they go through red lights, or at least amber lights, and the machines do exactly what they're supposed to do. And so we need a situation where all of this is going to work. So we're going to have to be a lot more real about what we expect the whole system to do. You know, we're not at the these days. There's a grey area in terms of how humans drive and the fact that they don't actually drive the way we say they should drive. So that's something that's going to have to be figured out. And it's interesting to think about how that might play out.
Is it a technical challenge or is this more of an organizational challenge?
Well, I think that it's an organizational challenge for sure. So it's a system challenge. So, you know, the technology is, you know, the work that we're doing, we're certainly working on the technology, but most of what we do is everything around the technology. You know, how does it impact society? How does it impact the economy? There are a huge number of questions, and, you know, it brings a lot of different industry sectors together. So it's the automotive industry, but it's lots of other industries as well coming together. And that's one of the exciting things we're doing around M-City is bringing all these different industry sectors in and communicating on how this is all going to go as we step forward. What's it mean for the insurance industry? What role will the telecommunications industry play in this? IT, you know, how does information technology play in all the data that's going to be generated? What are the opportunities with that data? Who owns the data? So many, many questions around this to create this system where, as we said a little earlier, we're sort of moving towards a mobility society where we pay for mobility by the mile or by the minute rather than maybe lease a vehicle every 3 months. You know, so it's a totally different experience, I think, for the user.
Okay, we just got another question that came in here from AMC Javelin Pierre Card Interior. Can people volunteer to be tourist pedestrians in M-City?
So we do have one mechatronic pedestrian in M-City by the name of Sebastian, and we'll have more. So we're not planning to use real. You know, a lot of people joke about, are you going to use students? You know, no, we're not going to do that. So really, M-City is designed to be a totally safe off-roadway test environment. So.
But here we've got two questions about people who want to go see this thing.
Yeah.
Can you stand off and sort of watch what's going on?
So we had a not necessarily, but we had an open day. We had the grand opening on the 20th of July. And later that week, we had an open day and 1,000 people showed up. Pretty good. So now, no doubt there will be more open days. So I think somebody earlier asked a question about, can I just show up? And so I guess not, because we're trying to get a bit of work done, you know. So, but there will be regular opportunities. So please look at our website, MTC, and you can see when these open days are going to be.
Do car companies rent time there, or, I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, so we...
We're down to about the last minute here, too.
Yeah, so we're just finishing the thing up, so we're getting all the electronics, all the smart stuff working in there. But, yes, basically, and we have partners. We have 51 industry partners signed to our program, so they have priority. They have priority. Mm-hmm. But it really, ultimately, it's open to everybody.
It's cool. It's a unique facility. I don't think there's anything else like it in the world.
The word unique gets misused a lot, but I think in this case, it's true.
Peter Sweatman, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours. Very good. I'm sure we're going to have you back at some point when you guys start to learn even more about what's going on there, but really appreciate your
time.
Thanks, John.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Firestone Destination LE2. Tough enough to handle anything the road throws at you.
Oops.
And you throw at it. Durable, dependable Firestone tires. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Hey, and we've got to let everybody know with that not only are we back, Daron Levine has joined us.
Thanks, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hey, do you have a microphone on?
I do.
Oh, okay. I just didn't see it from here. Okay.
I hope I'm heard, but
right.
I'm learning a new medium now, so.
Yeah, you got to tell us about this. So you've spent your whole career in print, right?
Right.
Now you're stepping into broadcast. Good for you, Daron.
Thank you very much. It's kind of parachuted out of heaven, but I'm starting a show called In the Driver's Seat on Sirius XM. Noon on Saturday.
Inside, what channel is that?
Insight 121.
121.
Okay. Yeah, there's a repeat show on Sunday morning at 9 a.m. I was quite surprised to learn in this world where I lived in newspapers that how many paid subscribers would you guess that Sirius has, by the way, Sirius XM?
Paid subscribers. I'll throw out a number. I have no idea. I'll say 5 million.
Okay. No less than 28 million paid subscribers. Now, they have a lot of stations, too.
Yeah.
But that kind of surprised me. So it's a very big outfit, and they don't have any original content in autos. So In the Driver's Seat will be about all things automotive. I hope you'll come and join me on the show sometime.
Sure. No, I'd love that.
Yeah.
So, and your first guest is Mary Barra.
Well, she was last week,
okay.
and this week we taped a show with Jim Cramer. So I had Mary Barra, and I then asked Jim Cramer to come and tell us what he thinks
about
it.
Those are two big gets. That's a great way to launch the show.
But I think they're connected in a way because Cramer's really interested in General Motors. He's interested in cars. He's interested in car companies. And he seemed like a very obvious person to ask about Mary Barra and about the state of GM, the state of the industry. And he has some interesting things to say.
Mm-hmm. So how'd this all come about? You got a call one day or
just
what?
Just got a call. And I don't know how or why it happened. It's just sort of happenstance. But I got a call and then we started talking about it, and they have a kind of an original. They started as a music network and then added Fox and NPR and CNN and some of those
all
other
kinds of
stations. They have a lot of sports on there, but they want to develop original content. So this was an idea for a show, and unfortunately, Click and Clack are no longer with us as a team, although a lot of their shows
still on the air.
Still on the air. Well,
I think our grandchildren are going to be listening to them.
That should be true of all of us, John. Yeah. So so it's just come together in the last couple of months, and I hope people will tune in.
So you give Howard Stern a run for his money?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I'm not in his league from a compensation standpoint.
But you're working on it.
But someday I'd like to be there.
So what, hour long show or
it's an hour long show?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And actually, the question I get from a lot of people is, well, you know, how do I listen to it if I'm not sitting in my car or listening to Sirius? And the answer is, if you're not a subscriber, you're not going to listen to it. But if you are a subscriber, there is a player that's on that you can download or get to on your computer, and then you can get programmatic material on demand, so it's available on demand.
Cool. Yeah. Good stuff. I'll definitely tune in. Good.
So did Mary say anything that surprised you?
Did Mary say anything? You know, what really surprised me about her was the fact that she was actually very staunch and very tough, very nice, very pleasant person, but I think very dedicated to GM and very committed to keeping the strategy she has, which is to kind of go it on their own. I think the big question out there right now is, can GM really go it on its own, or should she be talking to Sergio, to Fiat Chrysler? And actually, Kramer addresses that in his talk, so it's sort of interesting.
Well, okay, you've been writing about the business side of the industry for
your career,
two or three years.
Right. Two or three years.
Yeah.
Two or three decades.
You're not that old. Okay, so, I mean, what is your sense of it from all the reporting you've done over the years?
Well, I think that GM should not be closed-minded about it. I think that there's no reason to sort of preemptorily turn him down. I think have the conversation. I don't think that obligates you to do anything, but listen to what the guy's got to say. He's a very smart person. He's a very able leader. He's done really a lot. I think everybody who covers this industry would have to agree that he's gone pretty far with the cards he's been dealt. And so it would probably behoove General Motors to have that conversation. They may decide at the end of the conversation they don't want to do anything, or they may want to do something with him on a very limited basis. But if we look at the example of Carlos Ghosn and Dieter Zetsche and the folks from Nissan, really coming together and doing a whole bunch of projects that help save them some capital.
Sergio doesn't want to do that. He wants a full slam, bang, mash merger.
I don't think that's necessary. Well, you know, in any conversation, any negotiation, A wants something and B wants something else, and then sometimes they agree on something else again. So
that's the Hegelian dialect.
Yeah, right. Yes, yeah, exactly. It's the dialectic, right?
Dialectic.
So if you're an open-minded leader, you should be open to that, at least having that conversation. I won't keep you in suspense as to what Kramer said. Kramer said, look, he was kind of disappointed, and he sold GM stock, but he said that he thought that though he likes Mary Barr and he likes GM, he thinks that they should have that conversation. He said, you know, when you're Google, when you're Apple, when you're Amazon, you can afford to kind of blow people off and, you know, be peremptory. He said, when you're General Motors, you can't do that.
Yeah, the only thing is there's history between General Motors and Sergio. And it's a kind of, you know, burn me once, shame on you. Burn me twice, shame on me.
You know, I think
I
know what you're talking about.
All right, so this is the diesel situation?
Yeah,
so
the GM powertrain with Fiat.
Right. I would tell you that that payment at the end, that $2 billion payment that really stuck in GM's craw, was as a result of bad negotiating on their part back then. And I think you're right. It probably does kind of poison the well a little bit for them. But what happened was really not what Sergio did. Sergio did nothing but abide by the contract that they had. GM negotiated that contract very poorly.
No, I don't disagree with you whatsoever.
So for those who don't understand what we're talking about here,
so
basically there was an arrangement between General Motors and Fiat.
Yeah,
General Motors was looking for more knowledge and capability about diesel engines.
Right.
And so they went to Fiat because, being a European company, they had more experience with that. So then they got together and made a deal. And the deal just worked out better on Fiat's.
The deal didn't work out operationally for GM.
Right.
And then in the end, there was a put option, which Fiat exercised, which got
forced General Motors to turn over $2 billion to Fiat. Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, it still ticks them off today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes them angry. But, you know, why? Yeah. They didn't have to agree to it if they didn't want to.
No. Right. I'm not arguing. I'm just pointing out that it's not just his most recent plan that has them turned off against him.
Right.
It's this history that goes back over a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. I mean, this was unfolding in 2001, mm-hmm. right? And so this is a whole previous manager of General Motors. Again, why close your mind to that now? 15 years have gone by almost, and it's a different situation. It's actually literally a different company.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's something to be gained, why don't you go out and gain it?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you saying, well, you did this to us 15 years ago or 10 years ago?
I don't think it's just that. I'm just saying I think that's poisoned the water.
So here's an interesting fact that one of our viewers knew that I always like to have stuff in this blue notebook. And so a guy by the name of Rick Bradner sent in these numbers from Canada. And so at some point we may talk about sales, but this is very apropos. So it turns out that FCA actually has more sales in Canada than either Ford or General Motors.
I think I knew that they were the market leader.
So they're the market leader. So FCA has 15.8% of the market. Ford has 14.6% of the market. And GM has 13.6% of the market. So to your point, why shouldn't they talk to FCA?
Yeah.
They can get some advantage there.
There may be a lot of reasons. I mean, they could possibly decide together to put their truck business together. I mean, they're just...
Powertrain is where it should go, is my argument.
I mean, nobody really has refuted what he has to say, which is that there's a lot of destruction of capital in this business because of duplication of efforts and because of...
But I got to tell you something, Daron, because I looked into that, and he's right. You know, automotive provides low returns. Then I thought, I wonder how Boeing does. I wonder how Caterpillar does. I wonder how John Deere does. Same as automotive.
Well,
this is an industrial corporation kind of return you're going to get. Anything that involves big capital investment is going to give you, you know, a net margin return of maybe 4 or 5%, an operating return of 7 to 10%, 10% if you're in the luxury end. But where everybody's bitching about automotive stinks, I'm telling you, aerospace, off-road, and agricultural are in the same boat.
They're not great, but of course what happens with automotive is you have all these countries that keep these automobile companies in business when in fact the marketplace sometimes says you're out of business.
Yeah. Well, we got a lot more to get into in the second half of the show, including some more Dr. Data, and we're going to get to that in just a moment here.
Dr. Data. There's a reason why Drucker called it the industry of industries, because everybody wants to be in it.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. We're back.
So we want to pull a number?
Yeah, Dr. Data, let's hear it.
All right. So this is a very simple one. You know, many weeks I've had very complicated ones, but I saw the statistics. So the National Association of Realtors. Okay.
Hey, wait a minute. This is a car program.
Well, they had Portland State University do some research for them because they're interested in mobility.
We just heard
about mobility, and so they talked to various age cohorts to find out about their notions of mobility. And so I think Ben has an image here that we'll pull up. So the millennial generation, as it turns out, that they prefer walking to driving. 83% say that they like walking. 71% say they like driving. A 12% difference. Oh. So, of course, if you're planning a community, right, you'd be more oriented toward setting up walkways and things like that. So I got to ask you guys, what does that mean for this auto industry? As you were saying, it's the industry of industries when you have this young generation saying, you know what, maybe we prefer to walk.
Well, the first thing I'd probably ask is, where did you ask these millennials this question? If you ask them the question in the Mission District of San Francisco, where traffic is always in gridlock and people are zipping by in skateboards or walking together holding hands, in perfect weather, it makes perfect sense to me. So in the suburbs, where I grew up, you didn't want to walk. You wanted to have a car. But today, I think hand in hand with that trend is the trend to urbanization. So millennials, people, college age, college graduates, people growing up, they want to move from wherever they are, their parents' boring homes out in Bloomfield Hills or Scarsdale or, you know, Lake Forest, and they want to be in Chicago, and they want to be in Brooklyn, and they want to be in D.C.
So they don't want to drive.
I think they want to drive when they want to drive, but I think they like using their feet. I think they are satisfied calling Uber. They like Uber a lot from everything I hear. They like the opportunity to be able to call a car when they want it, have them come.
Or Zipcar.
Or Zipcar, Uber, Zipcar, Lyft, whatever it's going to be. Or sometimes even for the weekend to take a get around or drive now, which are ventures of car borrowing. So I think they're very much more imbued with a whole sharing economy, not just for cars, but for things like Airbnb. Okay, so Airbnb is a kind of a big popular thing now. When they can't afford to stay at the Ritz, never mind, you know, the Ramada Inn, so they like to go and stay at a place.
Okay, so if it used to be that you own a car, I own a car, John owns a car, now we have a generation coming up where they're saying, well, you know, Drone, we would like to borrow your car for a while, or John, we'd like to have your car for a day or two. This means that they're not going to be buying a car, right?
Right.
So does that have a downward pressure on overall sales, or
you know,
is this?
I don't think so. I just think it changes the ownership situation. I might want to, if I live in New York and I have access to a, let's say, a parking space, I may want to lease my I may want to lease my car, or I may want to have my own car and lease a second car. It's quite possible. I think that the car companies are thinking very deeply about these issues right now, because I think the sharing economy and the idea of crowding in cities is converging somewhat, so that when you think about the idea that some car is sitting there doing nothing 92% of the time or something like
right.
that, you say to yourself, well, why shouldn't it be out there doing something and earning its keep?
Especially if it's autonomous and it can just be called up on your phone.
And that's the next step, right?
It is.
The Uber shows up without the driver.
But it's interesting. I got a chance 2 days ago to interview Ian Robertson, board member at BMW, and they've got their own car sharing program called Drive Now. It's in 9 European cities. They've just launched a pilot program in San Francisco. In 3 years, they've gained 500,000 users, and it's one-third the cost of using a taxi. You use your smartphone with an app. You locate any BMW park, that's part of the program. Pick it up, drive it, drop it wherever you want within the city, and it's one-third the cost of using a taxi. And that was my question, kind of where you're going, Gary. Isn't this a threat to you guys? His take was no. These people are never going to buy a BMW anyway. They're not going to buy a car. They're going to use a bus, a subway, a taxi, or walk. And he says, instead, we've got 500,000 people using BMWs and paying us to use them. Personally, though, I think this is maybe not a threat to the industry, but it's going to put a cap on total car sales.
Well, I could definitely see BMW deciding, if this really got more and more popular, to create a new brand and a new car, taking advantage of the capital investment that they already have in engineering and saying, okay, you know, a BMW, that's a brand for a person who really wants to wear a car, who wants the prestige of BMW. Maybe we come up with something else. For you know, that takes that we can build in the same plants, use the same engineering, use all the advantages of making cars, and just use it for that.
Well, you know, in apparently earlier this week, BMW announced that they're putting several million dollars, it seems, because the real number hasn't been announced yet, in a company, Xerex, which is basically a valet parking service.
Yeah. Service. Explain that, Gary. That's pretty wild.
So basically, in San Francisco, as you were talking about earlier, so apparently there are these Xerex valets who are rolling around on things like scooters. I mean, actually, scooters.
Skateboards.
And skateboards. And so basically, you're in your vehicle, and you Uber-like get a hold of one of these guys, and they come, and they find a parking spot for you while you go on and do your business. And so BMW, so their iVentures, is putting money into this initiative.
So you pull up to the mall or some shopping area, there's your valet, you hand the car over to them, and you go do whatever you want.
Or you're in the middle of the Mission District, where, as you know, there's very little in the way of parking
right.
that anybody can possibly find. And so instead of spending all of your time driving around looking for a place to park, these guys come and take it for you. So here you have a situation where a you know, a company that we have historically thought of as being, oh, they make cars, right? Well, suddenly we find out that they have a car service whereby they're getting you into a car for a short period of time, and now they're investing in a service whereby you're getting out of that car and you're doing something else and not driving. So it becomes this entire shift whereby perhaps value will be made for companies, not necessarily by bending sheet metal and welding it together and producing these things, as much as it will be them providing a transportation service.
Well, I took to the airport the other day an Uber because I had to give my car to my son because his car was in the shop, and long story. But anyway, so I used Uber for the first time. I had never really used it here. And one of the great things about the app is you call them up. They tell you you're going to be here, and they're going to be there in 5 minutes or 6 minutes or 7 minutes. And then you go to the map on the app, and you see the car coming up to your house, and then it pulls up, and all the guesswork and all the suspense and all the fear that it is not going to show up or you're not going to find one. I think of the days I used to spend in New York City standing out in the rain trying to hail a cab. What a pain.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, you know, at the New York Auto Show earlier this year, when I came out of the Jacob Javits Center, there were more Uber cars out waiting to pick up people than there were yellow cabs.
Sure, and one of the interesting things about it is that the pricing is definitely demand pricing. So the only thing that's really allowed all of this to happen is sort of the digital economy, the idea that you can really measure how much demand there is at any one moment, that some genius wrote the software that's able to do that. I mean, this has all completely upset the normal taxi business, and of course cities now have to deal with this because there's kind of a political connection between who gets a taxi medallion, the city revenue, the use of these things on the streets, what citizens really want. These cities have a big political problem right now.
Well, it's interesting, you know, some statistics that the British government just came out with a couple of weeks ago where they're looking at the number of taxis and what they call private hire vehicles, which would be very Uber-like. And so basically they found that there were 242,000 licensed taxis and PHVs in England in 2015. Just under a third of these vehicles were taxis. So there's this phenomenal explosion of obviously the sharing or Uber-like economy that's going on around the world. It's just not
right
here.
I don't see that car companies really have much to worry about. The concept of ownership and who owns may change, but the idea of getting into an enclosed space, whether there's a driver or not, whether you own it or not, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
No, I would agree with that, but I do see the day coming where we're going to have far fewer vehicles on the road because of this mobility services thing coming. We'll have to do a whole show on that sometime, but I see it as a huge threat to automakers. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back. We'll talk more about the stuff and a whole bunch of other things. But we got to give a shout out to our good friends at FCA, Jeep in particular, I believe.
Here's a great gift.
What will you be able to see in a Jeep Renegade?
Running wild and running free.
Everything.
And I say, hey, living like we're renegades.
An available 2.4-liter multi-air engine that gets up to 31 miles per gallon highway. The available one-of-a-kind My Skyroof system. And a cabin that just won one of Ward's 10 best interiors. The all-new Jeep Renegade. Take off and take on anything.
Okay, we're back. And we've got a couple of questions here that Tweetermeyer sent in. And this goes back to the whole, you know.
That's Ed Niedermeyer, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. Exactly right. Tweetermeyer is his Twitter handle. So he says, Sergio Marchionne isn't touting specific synergies of his FCA-GM merger. Is the implication his leadership alone could unlock value at General Motors? Can it?
I've asked that question to a number of people. I said, let's say that these folks got into a serious discussion about a merger and the two boards got together and had to decide who the CEO was going to be. Would it be Sergio? Would it be Mary Barra? Would it be somebody else? And that's an interesting question. I think everybody has kind of a different answer. You sort of assume that since FCA is doing the asking and GM might be the target, that it could be either of them, right?
Has Sergio announced that he's going to be retiring within
2018 or something right. like that?
So by the time all the paperwork is done, he'd be a short-timer. Mary's younger than he is. Yeah. Mary's running the bigger of the two companies. Mary has done a good job at pulling the company up to the level that it's at.
I think they'd be a very good team. I could see her as CEO and him as chairman of the board of directors. Let him pick the directors. Let her work for the board. Why not?
Okay, there's a follow-up to this, too. Or is Sergio being vague about everything to keep the UAW and his dealers from strangling the plan in its cradle? Aren't big job cuts inevitable in a merger?
No question. I mean, there are some brands that are going to go away. There are some vehicles that are going to go away.
Here's the other thing, brands going away. What's it going to cost to close down brands? He hasn't talked about anything like that.
Well, but if you look at most FCA, US, LLC dealerships, they're all combined now. So Chrysler, Dodge,
but
Jeep.
You buy a franchise. You may have multi-franchises.
Right, but it's not the same as if he has a Buick store
Let's say they decide that, just for the sake of argument, Dodge goes away. Okay, so you're still a Chrysler, Jeep, Ram dealer.
Right, so you haven't closed the store.
And I haven't read the fine print of these franchise agreements, so I don't know in that event what happens, but I think that the idea is, the premise is, that the savings from these synergies would far outweigh whatever the costs are.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sold, but
you're not sold on it ever happening, or you're not sold on if it were to happen that it would be beneficial to anybody?
The latter, yes. It'd
be beneficial to Sergio.
It could be.
He could leave and he'd say.
Yeah, he could. But let's get on to some of the other things, because there's a whole lot that's been going on this week. Gary, you've been following all kinds of stuff, especially with Tesla.
Yes, this is big week for Tesla. That the Model X pricing came out.
They're taking specifications, right? Colors and equipment and so forth online.
If you buy the Signature Series.
Signature Series for $133,000.
That's right.
Including destination charge.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So you're able to do that. So that happened.
That's pretty pricey. Were you guys surprised by the price? I know this is a special model.
Right, because the other one that he's possibly going to have come out is going to be about the same price as a Model S. So that'd be $75,000.
Starting at $75,000, but nobody buys the $75,000 one.
Right.
It's there, $85,000, $90,000.
You have to ask.
Yeah, but how many cars, you're the numbers guy, how many cars are sold over the price of $70,000 in this country every year?
Lots of Teslas.
Everyone
that he can build, everyone he can get out of that factory.
No, it's a good point, Daron. If you look at...
It's just the market for cars that sell at retail at that price. It's not that
not
big.
Not a whole lot, right. No, if you look at cars $100,000 and above, Tesla has huge market share.
Right.
Huge market
right.
share.
Right. I mean, and that's the whole point about, we talked a couple weeks ago about the how phenomenally well they're doing in terms of they developed this vehicle that is... become the benchmark for every other manufacturer. And so when you see an announcement, as I think Automotive News reported today, about how, Mercedes is going to come out with a Tesla fighter. Okay, so how did this company come from nowhere to be a company whereby Mercedes has to say, we're having a fill-in-the-blank fighter?
I think Tesla's a very perplexing phenomenon to the people who run companies like Mercedes, BMW, Audi. Audi, to that point, is coming out with an e-tron.
Yeah.
It's aimed directly at Tesla.
It's their Tesla.
It's a Tesla fighter.
Right. They just don't call it a Tesla fighter.
Oh, no, they have called it.
Oh, they have.
They have. Yeah.
I'm not up to date.
Or what they said, now they're not calling it that. But what they said prior to this was, we need a Tesla fighter.
Right.
Right.
And then there was, and we didn't talk about this last week, but the thing came out where Consumer Reports basically said,
it's the best car that's ever built of any kind, anywhere.
And it's broken our scale.
But it's also broken down all kinds of times, and they've had to take it back for all these repairs and everything. So how can this this magazine that's built its reputation on saying we've got the Bible here when it comes to vehicle reliability claim that this car that breaks down more than anything else has broken their scale on how good cars can be.
Well, basically, there was a column actually last week in the Wall Street Journal or maybe it was earlier this week that Holman Jenkins wrote. And he said that, you know, Consumer Reports has just turned into a big disgrace now that they've gone so meretriciously into Tesla's corner. I mean, it's hard for me to accept the idea that of all the vehicles that have ever been built, that all the vehicles that they've ever tested, that this is the best one by far. What does that mean?
Something's got to be the best.
I guess that's right.
Hey, jumping topics here because we got so much to cover. What'd you guys make of August sales in the U.S.?
You know, we're in the sixth year now of an expansion, and nothing grows to the sky. I always feel like just when things look like they're going way over the top, that's when to watch out. And there are some signs that credit is being stretched, the amount, the length of leases, the number of long leases obviously being long in order to make the monthly payment smaller. All of that is a little troubling. I got to think we're getting close to the end of an automotive cycle.
So you're pessimistic about the future?
You know, I felt better about the expansion in year two than I do in year six.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say you're right. Now, remember, we also had the biggest collapse that we had ever seen.
Sure.
And if you look at sales in 2009, 10, and really into 11, it wasn't like what I would call growth. It got back to not the bottom falling out of the market.
Right.
It was barely stable. So even though it's true, yes, it's been 6 years, I would say maybe more realistically it's a 3 to 4 year expansion so far. I don't know.
But you know, I thought it was interesting, you know, to your point, Daron, about you know, leases and very inexpensive cars. So you were saying last week that you saw an ad in the
$74 a month for a Malibu.
And so I was looking at the sales numbers for Malibu, 17,553 cars in August, which is up 7.4% compared to last August. I mean, so I'm looking at that and saying, because they're down 2.5% for the year. So I think what we're seeing is exactly what Daron is talking about and what you identified, that, you know, maybe some of these car companies are greasing the skids to move this product a little bit too aggressively for their own good in the long run.
Well, I you know, it wouldn't surprise me if we have another year, maybe a little more to run
next year
before things get bad. But, you know, this stage of a cycle, whether it's anything, whether it's oil, whether it's stock, whether it's cars, almost anything can unseat it. So if there's a big disruption in China, say, right, or the Middle East, something like that could really slow things down, I think, rather dramatically. Although, is it true that the average age of a vehicle on the road right now is 11 years,
Just over 11 years now.
Okay,
yeah.
Now does that reflect people hanging on to their cars because they're scared, or does it reflect people able to keep cars for a much longer period of time because they're of dramatically higher quality, or maybe a little bit of both?
I'd say more the latter than the former.
I think it's two things. I think cars last far longer than they ever did before. And the second thing is that for the average American household income has flatlined for 20
right.
years.
Yes.
They can only afford a used car. Thank God they last as long as they do.
Right. Well, and you're seeing the transaction costs for cars, you know, above $30,000. I mean,
$33,000.
Right. Who would have thought that? I mean, that is an average car.
And guess what? It's going to go up a lot faster because up to now, CAFE has been easy to meet. It's all the low-hanging fruit. After 2017, that's when it really ramps up. That's when the real expensive technology is going to start to come in.
So to my point originally, as transaction price goes up, you need more credit. You know, you need longer periods of time for this. Folks are stretched. You know, at some point, things hit the wall,
right.
And then they have to kind of reevaluate again.
No, I totally agree with you. There's a downturn out there.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
There always
say
has
when,
been. It's you know.
It will happen.
So does this mean this will be just in time? So we'll have this problem in the Middle East. There'll be an oil problem. It'll be just in time for Tesla to come out with their $35,000 car, which will then be the average price of a vehicle, and they'll just you know, he'll have the Gigafactory running.
Listen, I've been cautious about Tesla all along. It looks to me like a vehicle that's very much for the upper crust and only the upper crust. But I think that this $35,000 Tesla, if it comes out, if it can be produced in mass quantities for that price and at that same level of quality and buzz that the bigger vehicles got, I become a believer at that point. I think then it does look to me like a potentially $30 billion market cap company.
You know, and I thought it was interesting that Jaguar announced today that is going to be coming out in model year 17, the XE25T, with an MSRP starting at $34,900.
Well, they have to do this. I mean, this is where Mercedes and BMW and Audi are going. They have to follow these people down or they're going to be isolated.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, what Jaguar essentially announced today was an across-the-board price cut.
Right.
They sort of took a page out of Hyundai's marketing plan. They have now the best warranty in the luxury segment, 5 years, 60,000 miles, free 24-hour roadside service, free maintenance for scheduled items. I mean, look, they've hit the panic button. Tesla now outsells Jaguar in the U.S. market. Here we've got not only a strong U.S. market, the luxury segment is red hot. And what's Jaguar sales? They're down more than 4%, 4.5%.
So let me ask you, John, do you think that Jaguar as an enterprise has struggled since going into Tata?
No. Tata bought a basket case from the Ford Motor Company. And I say basket case in the sense that it needed a mega amount of investment.
It was not doing well at Ford.
Not just the entire lineup. They have to do all new powertrain, everything. They're spending mega. What's so impressive is JLR, you know, on one hand is doing quite well. They're doing a $4 billion EBIT. The problem is they're spending $5 billion on new plants and models. So, you know, that's a recipe for extinction as that runs. But look, it's a storied brand. They can turn it around. It's so smart now they're finally going to get into crossovers, which is where the whole market's going. That's their problem. They only sell cars, and passenger cars are going nowhere right now.
So maybe it's too late for them.
I don't think it's too late. The real question is, I think they sold, 87,000 cars last year? Jaguar did? Mm-hmm. That's nowhere near enough to support.
Is that the U.S. or worldwide?
No, I believe that's worldwide.
No, that's my point. Is that that's why I say it. That's why I use the verb struggle.
Well, this is just through August. So for total Jaguar, 10,221 cars. So that's 8 months.
Yeah. So that the number I just threw out is a global number then.
Okay.
I mean, I think the most heartening thing about Jaguar they've been able to resurrect the brand and the image of Jaguar. I don't think that has been hurt.
No, I agree with that.
But this is interesting, your point about how they need a crossover, they need something, okay, because now the name of the company is Jaguar Land Rover, you know, all one big long one word, right? And so, you know, we've got 10,000 and change so far from Jag. Land Rover, the other side of the house, is 42.5.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that's
an SUV company.
Right, four times as much, you know, and all Jag has is sedans.
So JLR is doing okay in SUVs.
They're brilliant, you know, and this was always the argument. Oh, Jaguar doesn't need to go into SUVs or crossovers because we have Land Rover. The whole market's going to crossovers. And so you're not there,
three,
you're
it
dead.
It takes 3 years to develop a car, to develop a crossover. Could it be that by the time they get here with these crossovers, the market will have moved back to something else?
It's going to be next year, isn't it, that they're going to have the F-Pace?
Right. They'll have the production version at the Frankfurt show.
Right.
And
okay.
It'll be in this market next year, I believe. But I don't think so, Daron. This is a fundamental shift globally in the market. I don't think we've ever, in the history of the auto industry, seen such a segment shift as we're seeing now of people running, sprinting to the crossover segment. And, you know, and small crossovers, the most red hot of all. Now they're coming off of, a small base, so it's a huge
percentage. Okay, so why is that, John? Why?
I've got a column running in Wards on this right now where I take a look at a lot of things, and it's a combination of factors. It's the look of the vehicle. It sits a little bit higher off the ground. It's taller. You get this what the industry calls the command seating position, where you can see over other cars and the like. They're roomier than their
passenger car counterparts. And it's this total combination of factors: more room, more luggage space, taller, looks like it's got ground
clearance. But they're not new in concept. So maybe are we saying that, in a sense, that the designers and engineers have finally gotten the packaging and design to a point where people say, yeah, I can drive that without feeling that I have to drive a station wagon or a minivan, or I've been labeled as a, you know.
But what's so interesting is, you know, when you think about it, a crossover is really a hatchback. It really is. You know,
oh, but
seating,
don't call it that.
I know, yeah. But hatchbacks, you can't give away.
It's not a dirty word anymore. It's only for our generation it's a dirty word.
Yeah. You can't give away hatchbacks. Minivans have a stigma to them. But if you get this right shape, and essentially, here's my formula. You take a front-wheel drive passenger platform. You drop a two-box top hat on it. You raise it another 6 inches.
You're going to have to translate this into English for the viewers at home.
You raise it another 6 inches off the ground. You put some stuff on the wheel wells to emphasize how muscular they are. You slant the C-pillar forward a little bit.
You put some beautiful headlights and beautiful taillights on them.
Yeah,
but everything's got that.
Well, yeah, but you know,
here's a simple reason. Here's a simple thing. Think about it this way. Okay, so why are people more interested in crossovers now than perhaps at a different time? If you look at the top three selling vehicles, okay, it's the Ford F-Series, the Chevy Silverado, and the Ram 1500. Okay, there you go. So what is the likelihood you want to be driving in something that is low and small? Okay, you want something that is large and tall because you're driving up against those guys.
So this is a fashion statement that's rooted in self-defense against pickup
trucks. I think it's absolute self-defense. I think that there's no question about that.
That's
funny. Because if you wanted really, you know, small and stylish, then why is the Fiat 500 doing so poorly? Do you want to be rolling down 696 in a Fiat 500 while you're being surrounded by these things?
It's preposterously small for American roads. That's why it's doing poorly.
But, I mean, but if you look at cars, which is what John was saying earlier, I mean, even small cars are not doing that great.
Well, I think that the designers and the stylists have really succeeded in making some of these crossovers look very, very attractive. I was looking at a Ford Escape, which is not a super expensive car, and it's coming by me today. You know, it's a good-looking vehicle.
It is. And what I find so fascinating is this whole crossover thing. It's a global phenomenon. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in China. You go anywhere in the world, and it's like somebody threw a switch and the public said, "Pooh, give me more crossovers."
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah.
Okay, what else do we have? Well, can you talk about the Lexus RX?
Well,
I know you were out driving.
So the RX, which basically launched the luxury crossover in 1998.
The original.
They've sold 2.1 million units of the vehicle since they launched it, so it's basically Lexus bread and butter. And while I can't talk about the driving impressions that I have on that vehicle, those guys have basically, you know, we've long criticized Toyota and Lexus for being soulless and for being appliances, for not having very
boring.
Much style, for being boring. And I would submit that if you look at what Lexus has been doing in terms of transforming its lineup, whether it's cars or now crossovers, I mean, they came out with the NX, the compact crossover, which, as you said, is
the most red hot segment in the market.
Is that a B segment or
yes,
C? It's a B segment.
And so now they've come out with the RX, or will be coming out with the RX, which, you know, from the front has that wild aggressive look that the NX has, the spindle grill. These guys have you can see it on the screen here. So you know, if you look at what, you know, the RX has, you know, historically been just a basic, you know, let's call it innocuous. But those guys have just said, you know what? The hell with it. We're gonna go all the way. We're gonna really provide some design in this thing that will be unlike anything out there. And it's truly, I mean, you see that vehicle? There's nothing like that on the road.
Well, if you remember what
except
happened,
except for the NX, which is small.
If you remember what happened to Toyota after they had this sort of big meltdown with the sudden acceleration scandal and so forth and so on. When Akio Toyota came in, one of the things he said was, "We're going to make our cars more exciting."
And one of the things
these guys got the message.
And so the chief engineer on this vehicle was the chief engineer on the last generation. So this is the fourth generation. He was the chief engineer for the third generation and now the fourth generation, which is, and I talked to him about this, and it's very atypical that a chief engineer gets to do two cars in a row. And
not a Toyota.
No, he said that when they were smaller, it was sort of common, but in years since, it's all changed up. Yeah, everybody goes elsewhere.
I remember meeting a guy that was on his fourth generation Corolla.
Right, and that's
fourth.
That's probably when all the chief engineers could have sat in this room, and right in this space. But anyway, he said that Akio came in a month before design freeze and said, this isn't as expressive as we want this to be. And he's, you know, and the chief engineer said,
we want this spindle grill to be even bigger.
Well, I mean, and so those guys had
Remember when we had the guys in here from Nissan Murano?
Right.
Same thing. It was like, we don't want that boring design.
Right. So, you know, you can see it, you know, to your point that, you know, Akio has come in and said, we want these cars to be
so
very
this,
emotional.
This vehicle that you're driving, this is coming to market soon?
Yeah.
How soon?
Month.
Month. And have they had they've had an introduction of it already to the press?
Just
but,
this
but
week.
It's under embargo.
This week.
It's this week, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's and it's also interesting, this is a global launch. So ordinarily what we all generally take part in North America
regional
anyway.
Launches.
Or it's just a U.S. launch. I mean, there'll be a car, it'll be a U.S. launch. And I mean, when they did the previous generation of this car, it was just the U.S. media. But they're bringing in journalists from all over the world to Portland to drive this thing, because this is another part of their strategy. They're saying, okay, you know, we're in over 90 markets, Lexus. We know that our competitors are in over 200 markets, Mercedes, BMW, mm-hmm. folks like that. And so we're now going to bring in the world to drive these vehicles.
Well, this is really sort of the next big leap forward for Lexus, because of course this was a brand that was invented for this market, mm-hmm. and is now up against Mercedes, BMW, Audi, which are global, to your point, are global brands. And Lexus does not do well in Europe. Really, I don't think it's taken off even in Japan.
That's right.
in a big way. The only place you really go and see a lot of Lexuses are in the United States. So if they really want to do something with this brand, they got to figure out a way to get people's attention. And I don't see, I've always sort of been astonished that they haven't done better than they've done, even in the backyard of BMW and Mercedes. But maybe they got a plan.
Mm-hmm. They do have a plan, but it's going to take years before they can, you know, break down the walls in Europe.
Yeah.
But to your point, even in Japan, they sell cars, but it's not become like the dominant luxury brand over there by any stretch.
But I think part of that is that many of the vehicles that Toyota has on offer in Japan, it's sort of like what Mercedes has on offer in Germany, mm-hmm. whereby, you know, you can just have a regular car, right? I mean, taxi cabs are you know, E-classes. I mean, it's right. No big deal, right?
Right.
And I think similarly in Japan, Toyota goes up higher than Avalon here. Therefore, you don't necessarily need Lexus there the same way you'd need it here.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, you know, when you talk about luxury vehicles, if you go over to Ford and say, well, where are your real luxury vehicles? They'd say it's that $60,000 pickup truck that I sell. That's my luxury vehicle, mm-hmm. with
that's
leather
true.
And everything
mm-hmm.
there. Yeah.
Yeah, and they make massive margins on it. Hey, look, it's probably time to wrap this up. Man, we didn't even get to talk about the BMW 7 Series.
Next week.
We got to talk about it. We learned a lot of interesting things. What a car. But Daron Levine, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, John.
Sirius XM Radio, Channel 121.
Insight.
There you go.
Do you say break a leg to guys on radio?
You know, I say I hope I don't break anything more than a leg.
Real good. Gary, great seeing you. We'll be back here next week.
Okay.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.